I am Elle Penelope, author of epic fantasy and paranormal romance, and welcome to My Imaginary Friends, a look behind the scenes of an author mapping the worlds in my head and making them a reality. Just a quick technical note about today's episode. There is a weird audio issue that starts partway through and then I figure out and fix, but it's there for a while and it's super annoying. So I'm sorry about that. And now back to your regularly scheduled podcast. Hello, friends. Today is Saturday, December 14th, 2019, and this is episode 45 of My Imaginary Friends. I'm Leslie. So this week's best thing is that we adopted a new kitten. His name is Stokely, and he is 11 weeks old. You can check out my Instagram for pictures of him. I'll put a link in the show notes. So we were not planning to adopt a kitten. We hadn't really had any discussions about a new animal. But what happened was, last Saturday, my husband went to the pet store to buy dog food. And then I get a text with pictures of kittens, and apparently there was an adoption event there, and, you know, he can't pass by a kitten without at least holding it. So we got into a conversation with the woman who was there, who was fostering these six kittens, and they were all black, and he got to talk to her about their personalities. And so since we have two dogs and a cat, and our original cat, Sterling, is a bit of a handful. He is a little surly, a little mean. He is resting bitch face, we like to say. We knew that if we ever, the only conversation we had had at that point long ago were that if we ever got another cat, he would have to be a nice cat. So, they were talking, and so I get this call about this kitten, and I'm like, well, these pictures are nice, you know, I don't know what you're sending them to me for. And it's like, well, they're here, and do you want to come see them? And I'm like, well, can I come tomorrow? And he's like, no, they're going. They're gonna be gone at 3, because I had thought they were just like the cats that lived in the store. I didn't know what store he went to. So anyway, he comes home and picks me up. We go back to the pet store, and we end up adopting a new kitten. It is because when you adopt from a shelter, you know, you don't get to know much about the personality. Adopting from foster at least allows you to, you know, talk to someone who has lived with the animal. And so these kittens were fostered in a house that has other dogs and cats. So we were like, yeah, make sure that they're calm, that, you know, the kitten isn't terribly intimidated by dogs and can get along with cats. And so Stokely was very mellow, we were assured, and he is. It's true. I mean, he's a kitten, so he's insane and runs around in circles quite a lot, but he does not have any problem with our two big pit bulls. Sterling actually hid from the kitten for the first day, and then finally, it only took him a day to come out, which for him is great, because when we bought Sherman home 2 years ago, we didn't see Sterling for about 7 months. Like, he was under the bed the entire time. He would come out in the middle of the night to eat, apparently, and use the bathroom. I mean, we saw glimpses of him, but he was gone. He was MIA. And it has taken almost the full 2 years that we've had Sherman, our second dog, for Sterling to be okay with him. But he does seem to be okay with the kitten. And Stokely actually is the alpha of the pack. Odd as it is, he's very confident. He is not afraid of anything. As I record this, he has taken over Sherman's bed. So Sherman has a bed in my office. And because Sable, who's our older dog, stays downstairs a lot more because of her arthritis. Like, she can go up down the steps if she wants to, but she doesn't want to often. So anyway, the tiny kitten is in the dog bed and Sherman is on the floor sleeping. So that's how that's going. You know, cats are great stress relievers. So there's this thing that I call cat meditation, which is where Sterling, who is 15 pounds and the same weight as my gravity blanket, will lie on me and purr. And, you know, just the vibration of the purring and the weight on top of me is extremely relaxing. So usually I'm on my stomach, like I sleep on my stomach a lot, and he will climb up on my back and just fall asleep there. Or sometimes, you know, he'll climb in my lap. But it is definitely a great stress reliever. And the kitten, Stokely does not like to be held, so Stokely actually does. We can pick him up and hold him and cuddle him, and he's totally amenable to that. So yeah, having two is not that much different than having one, and especially having a nice one. Sterling, I could actually not, I was going to be like, Sterling can be nice, but I don't know that what he does could ever be called nice. Even with a prickly cat, I think they do enrich your life, just like in different ways than dogs do. But yeah, so now we have a full house with two dogs, two cats. And one of the other reasons why I think my husband was really interested in these kittens were that black animals are always more difficult to adopt. Black dogs get put down more often, and black cats are adopted less frequently. So he's a tuxedo, so he's mostly black with a white chest and a white nose. And there are some people walking through my backyard right now. I don't know where they're going. It's not like a path. It's just woods and trees. There's a whole family of humans. Usually there's families of deer back there. But that's very distracting. So anyway, new kitten. Very happy about that. Other great things that happened this week. Last Sunday's episode of Watchmen was fantastic. If you're not watching this show, I highly, highly recommend you watch it. It was episode 8. It's called A God Walks Into a Bar. And I was telling someone, it is quite possibly one of the best episodes of television of any show that I've ever seen. It's hard to describe. I'm going to link to a recap of it. So if you have seen it, this is a great recap. If you haven't seen it, it's going to be full of spoilers and probably not make any sense. But I just thought that the article, it was really well done. And the conceit of the article is that it takes the shape that the episode took. So the episode is sort of the character travels through time and experiences all of time at the same time. But the way they handle it is just so deft and like, It ties threads of the story that have been building all season, and the acting is just amazing, and you can follow it even though it has all these time jumps and logic jumps, and then I just can't say enough good things about it. I mean, this show is building on something, and there's so much weirdness about it, and there's so much that's just unusual and strange, but like delightfully strange. And then you're seeing it wrap up, and this is the penultimate, so one more episode left. I think it's going to be a super long one, at least I hope, this Sunday, tomorrow, actually, as I'm recording. But yeah, episode 8, season 1, Watchmen, just fantastic television. Another great thing from this week, the In the Heights trailer dropped. I just watched it again before I started recording, and I got, like, choked up. I mean, the trailer is so beautiful. I listened to the soundtrack a lot. So In the Heights was Lin-Manuel Miranda's first musical of Hamilton fame. And I've only seen the show once. I saw it locally in Maryland at like one of the higher end community theaters. So it had one of the members of the original Broadway cast was playing Usnavi, not the original Usnavi, which was Lin-Manuel, but the guy who played his cousin, and I can't remember the character's name right now. So older now, he's old enough to play Usnavi. And the rest of the cast were local. And DC has a good theater scene, but there were some newbies in the cast. And the night we saw it, there were two understudies who went on. And they were like, this is their first show. And it showed. So it was not the greatest performance, which was a shame. But even with some questionable performances mixed in with, you know, some better ones, it's still a fantastic show. And I'm super excited about the movie. And that trailer is just gorgeous and gave me all the feels. So it sent chills up my spine. I'm super happy about it. So in research news, I had mentioned the story that I'm, you know, that's incubating in my mind, this heist story. Still is just a kernel. I don't have much more or anything more than I had last week. I haven't spent any time thinking about it because this week has been a beast. But I did manage to watch the original Ocean's 11. It's on Netflix if you are interested in it. So as of December 2019. So yeah, original Ocean's 11 stars Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., and the Rat Pack. Cesar Romero is in it. And I didn't even know that was him until after I finished watching the movie and Googled it. I wasn't paying attention to the opening credits, I guess. And then I was like, oh, this is the Joker from the Batman TV show? But Yeah, I did not enjoy this movie. I like old movies. I have a high tolerance for all of the old movie foolishness that goes on. Like, for instance, there was one scene where three of the white men are putting on blackface for a reason in the movie. And I think Frank Sinatra jokes with Sammy Davis Jr. like, how do you get this stuff off? Like, hearty har har, you know? But I mean, yeah, there was stuff like that, that sign of the times, you know, I can't fault the movie for that because that's life. But I just, as a film, like, the characters weren't charming. Danny Ocean. The only things that were similar to the one that we know and love from Steven Soderbergh, the George Clooney version, is the name Danny Ocean, and that he was a man with an estranged wife, and that he got a crew of 11 people together, casinos in Las Vegas. That is literally the only thing that is similar about those two movies. In the original, yes, Danny Ocean still loved his wife and wanted to reconcile with her, but he was also cheating on her with this, you know, harpy woman who causes trouble for the crew. And yeah, that's lovely. he was pulling pranks on the guy who was like sponsoring them, and they were kind of mean-spirited. Like, maybe it, just like with like the racial and sexist stuff that was in there, maybe some of these jokes just hit really hard in 1960. And even though I watch old movies, I'm not like steeped in whatever the culture was at that point to find these quote unquote jokes funny. But there were just like story threads that didn't go anywhere. And the ending was bittersweet. I'm going to go ahead and spoil the ending of this 60-year-old movie for you because it is different than the ending of Ocean's 11, of the George Clooney version. So in the end, that they pull off the heist without a hitch. It's all very elegantly done. But then through the course of events, someone is on to them and they have to move the money. And by the end of it, $11 million that they had stolen, I think it was $11 million, whatever that the amount of money was that they had stolen, ends up being cremated with the body of one of the guys who died, and they end up with nothing. And the last shot is them walking down the strip, very sad, as the credits roll over their faces. And by that point, I was like, yeah, you guys didn't really deserve that money. You guys were all jackasses, and I don't care that he didn't get it, you know? Like, I was kind of like, wait, what? And then I realized the movie was over, and that was the end, and I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess y'all should have not been such terrible people. So it is impressive to me that whoever had the idea to take that movie and turn it into the Soderbergh version, I mean, it's mind-blowing. Like, I don't know how you watch that movie and be like, well, I can see how you can watch it and be like, I can improve this. So maybe that's what happened. Like, this is an interesting idea. Let me make it actually enjoyable to watch and full of fun people that you really want to get away with this crime. Or maybe the 60s were just more moral than today. And the moral of the story is that crime doesn't pay, which is the opposite of the Ocean's 11 that we know and love today. I don't know. But I watched it and I can check it off my list and I will move on to something more modern. Wrist update. Physical therapy is going really well. I went climbing twice this week at the gym, so I'm following my physical therapist's recommendations and taking it very easy. I'm doing mostly laterals. I'm not going to get too much in the weeds with that, but I am much happier. So, and my wrists and my thumb is improving. She did something that is called dry needling on my forearm because apparently my wrist pain is part of it is referred pain from my forearm, and you know, I talked about it, an old shoulder injury too, but she's focusing on the forearm. And so dry needling is basically sticking needles into like trigger points or knots on your forearm. And she sticks the needle in into it and kind of releases it. It's not exactly comfortable, but it helps. I mean, it helped me so much. Like immediately after she takes the needle out and I'm like still wincing a little bit, I can move my wrist. I can grip, and I was having trouble touching my fingers together, like touching my thumb to my other fingers, holding a pen, cutting with knives. Like all of that is improved. I still have pain. You know, it's not back to normal. I don't know if it'll ever be 100%, but I'm just really hoping that I can build up the strength back in my wrist and, you know, get to a place where I'm really functional and I don't have to, and I can at least, you know, do regular tasks with a minimum of pain. But yeah, so back in the gyms, I'm so weak. I'm so sad to be so weak. I can't do any pull-ups, I had worked so hard, you know, to get to the point where I could do pull-ups. I think it'll come back easy. I mean, it should come back much easier than it originally was to do them. I haven't lost all of my strength, but I still can't grip really hard enough to try super hard. But yeah, holding weights, I can hold them again. I haven't really been able to do that, like light weights. And yeah, just being back and able to at least participate a little bit in the thing that I love to do is just makes me so happy, and it makes me much more motivated to actually exercise. You know, there's most of the exercises require holding a weight of some kind, but the ones that I did, you know, or using your body weight and using your wrist or supporting your weight with your wrist to put, you know, push-ups, and not being able to do that. Yes, I could have modified and done some other wrist-free exercises, but I was kind of just in a funk about not being able to do what I wanted to do. So I have not really been exercising except for some cardio. But now I feel way more motivated to get back to it, even with like light baby weights. Like, she gave me a 5-pound kettlebell, and you know, I was like, I don't have weights this light at my house. I guess I could buy some light weights, but you know, they have, obviously, they don't have any weights that light at the gym. Like, they have dumbbells, but not for kettlebells. I digress. Anyway, it's going well. There is more progress being made, and I'm super excited about that. I'm going down from twice a week physical therapy to once a week, and as I continue to improve. So, the writing update, which I have been procrastinating about mentioning in this podcast episode. Well, one part is 100% great. So I finished the novella, Hush of Storm and Sorrow, which is book 2.5 of the Earthsinger Chronicles. I sent it to the copy editor, and that is a huge relief, a big weight off my shoulder to be through that process. I actually reread the whole thing this morning, and I'm really happy with it. You know, since this week was so difficult for work reasons, there were 2 whole days when I did not get to write at all. And that was terrifying to me, like the week of a deadline. But I had this work project that was just sucking all of my energy, and it was launching, as a website that was launching this week. So that's why I am technically a day late. My due date was technically yesterday, but it was Friday. And when I said it knowing that she wasn't going to look at it over the weekend. So if I needed those 2 extra days, I could have them. I didn't get a chance to polish it as much as I would have if this week had gone differently. Now rereading it this morning, I think it's fine, but I'm also still very close to it. As I've had this experience over and over again of not having as much time as I would like to because of deadlines, I have been able to trust myself more. Like, if I read it and I think it's good, it's probably pretty good. Like, it's probably pretty much there. I did send it to some beta readers. Of course, not the order I would like to do it. Like, ideally, beta readers, then you revise it, then you send it to the copy editor. But that did not happen. And now, this is a self-published book, so, you know, I am in control of the schedule and everything. But working with an editor whose time books up, you know, I knew that I did not want to be late because that would mess her up and it might push back things depending on her schedule. So I was bound and determined to get it and just get it off my plate also, so that I can free up my brain for other things, because it's been a big, I don't want to say a drain, but it's been a big chunk of my focus, and it just feels really wonderful to not have it be on my mind for a few weeks. The other part of my writing update. I heard from my editor at St. Martin's that books 3 and 4 of Earthsinger Chronicles are going to be pushed back. So book 3, Cry of Metal and Bone, was supposed to be published on May 19th of 2020, It's been on pre-order, but now it's going to come out in August. And then book four will be pushed to winter 2021. And it's because she said that, you know, the marketing department needed more time to ramp up. Things had been running late. And, you know, traditional publishing needs a really long lead time. So that is what's happening with that. It is bittersweet. On the one hand, it's good because, you know, I've been struggling with book four and the manuscript, and I'd asked for more time on it. And so now it just releases that pressure on book four, and I'll have the time that I need to work on it and get it where I want it to be to finish the series. But, you know, I hate having something pushed back. It's not like a good feeling or anything. I've already updated my website. I have to send that newsletter, that same newsletter that did not get sent out in November and has not as of yet gotten sent out in December. But at least now I will have a lot of juicy news for it. So maybe that's a good thing. I absolutely must send it out this week because I don't want to push it till Christmas, and it's already been ridiculously long. That is what's happening with that. My agent reassures me that, you know, this is a good thing to give marketing and sales all the time they need to promote the book, which I totally understand. And I'm not really upset about it. I guess, you know, this week has just been so crazy that I was a little bit numb. But yeah, it's disappointing to have to tell people I'll have to wait longer. But that's just the way it is. I don't have any control over it. And I'm hopeful that it will, you know, mean good things in the end for the book. The other thing that my editor said was that, you know, there are opportunities with these last two books because they've never been in the marketplace before, whereas books one and two were self-published. So yeah, those are just the ups and downs of publishing. And like I said, I'm not super upset about it. It's just, it is what it is. Finally, there was an interesting post that showed up on my Instagram feed that I will link to. It seems like it's from an essay by an author called Gloria Anzaldúa. And I looked it up, and it appears to be from a book of essays. And I'm not really the kind of person who reads books of essays, but I'm intrigued by this one, and so I might try to check this out. Because it was just some really beautiful sentiments about writing. So the quote is, she's talking about her process of writing one of her books. And she says, "One thing I urge you to do when you're reading and writing is to figure out, literally, where your feet stand, what position you're taking. Are you speaking from a white, male, middle-class perspective? Are you speaking from a working-class, colored, ethnic location? For whom are you speaking? To whom are you speaking? What is the context? Where do you locate your experience?" And I've been thinking about that, and another part of it is about why she writes. She says, "I write because it's my calling, my task to do in the world. It is a ritual, a habit, a propensity bred in my bones. It is what I do." And then it says, "I write because I want to leave a discernible mark on the world." And that was a really beautiful sentiment that I just really appreciated. And it sort of connected to a podcast episode that I was listening to where they mentioned something about the white default. And that is that, you know, in most slash virtually all books, it's assumed that the characters are white unless specified otherwise. So people who are not white are described, their skin color is described. And these two podcasters are both authors of color. And they were saying that it is incumbent upon the writer to describe the character, especially if they're black or brown. And on the one hand, I do agree with that, but only if the author has accepted the white default. So there are books that I've read where halfway through the book, you find out that this character is black all of a sudden. And I get mad at that because I'm like, okay, that's too late. You know, you should have told me earlier so that I could picture this character. Like, finding out that they're black on the last page is like, wait, what? Or when you don't find out at all, and then the author makes some statement, like, in Divergent, you know, apparently Four was biracial this whole time, or like, you know, Dumbledore was gay. Like, who knew? Oh, well, I didn't tell you that. It wasn't in the book. I'm just telling you now. It's a bonus. You know, that feels wrong you know, and kind of immediately a little disingenuous, you know. But I've had the experience, especially like in a critique group when, for a short story, it was actually a short story that appeared in the Heart's Kiss magazine. And, you know, everyone in the critique group was white. So one of these women read the story, and at a certain point, like in the middle of this story, I described the character's skin colors and they're black. And she was like, oh, well, you know, this is kind of late. And, you know, basically the same reaction I had had to this other book. But I operate under a black default. All of my characters are black, you know, unless I tell you otherwise. Now, I realize that most of the readers are not operating under a black default, but it's my way of challenging the white default. And it is something I think about, you know, like if you're doing a thing that no one knows you're doing, is it effective? For example, I don't describe any skin colors in Song of Blood and Stone. And that was a conscious decision. I have these two races of people and they have different skin colors. And, you know, the Lagrimari have dark hair and dark eyes and the Alcyrians have red hair and freckles. And I've read reviews where people say, oh, they're coated white. And on the one hand, I can see why they say that. But on the other hand, I have, you know, I know plenty of black people with red hair and freckles. And it depends on your perspective and it depends on your default. And so I operate my career as working from a black default, and that's my paradigm. And I totally understand when people read my books and they believe that the characters look, you know, a certain way based on their default. And I don't describe the skin colors on purpose as my way of confronting the white default. But I can understand if someone doesn't agree with that choice. Like when I workshopped Song of Blood and Stone over these many years ago, I had mentioned that, and my, you know, the teacher in the workshop, who was Marjorie M. Liu, she was just like, I'm not sure about that, you know? So I can definitely accept an argument that says that that's not fair. You should tell us what they look like, because when I read a story and there's black people in it, you know, and I'm reading and I would love to see, you know, people who look like me in the story. And if they don't tell me that they look like me, then I won't know. But that is because I assume, unless someone tells me otherwise, that most of these authors are working from the white default, especially if they're white. So when this essay author is talking about who, you know, for whom are you speaking? To whom are you speaking? Who am I writing to? To whom am I writing? I think it's important, as much as possible, to operate outside of the white gaze. And what does that look like? And how possible even is it? You know, like, I don't know. These are questions. And if someone is confused or disagrees with my choice, I accept that. I take it. You know, it would be clearer if I said, well, these people are this color and these people are this color. And then you get into, how do you describe skin color? And, oh, you're not supposed to use food anymore. Like, I don't have a problem using food. I don't know. Just things I'm thinking about, things that, you know, conversations to have that I think would be interesting and that were kind of just sparked by, you know, these two things that somehow connected in my mind. Another part of this quote: everybody has a stake. You're doing it because you are affirming your ethnic identity. You want to document your experience. You want to find meaning in it. You don't want your voice erased. These may be some of the stakes for people of color. I think there are high stakes in terms of confronting the white default. And I don't know how exactly, you know, we do that. And everyone's going to do it in their own way. So this was the way that I decided to do it when I wrote the book. And considering that there's three versions of Song of Blood and Stone out in the world, I stand by it for this series. Now, if I was starting all over again today from the beginning, I might do it differently. I might not. I really don't know. I think that as I go forward and as I continue to try to challenge myself in my writing, I will attack these things that are of concern to me, that I feel are important to engage with and to address, I'll probably deal with them differently. And I'll deal with them in a variety of ways, in a variety of stories. So that is all for me for this week. I hope that you have a wonderful week and that you are prepared for the holidays and the weather and whatever else the end of the year brings. As I go forward, I'm going to start doing my end of the year review and planning for next year. Yeah, as things wrap up, it is a time, you know, a good time to look back and review and evaluate and then get ready for 2020. It's almost here. For episode show notes and to sign up for the Footnotes newsletter, go to myimaginaryfriendsshow.com. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave a rating or review to help support the show. My Imaginary Friends is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. For more terrific podcasts, check out frolic.media/podcasts.